Thank you for downloading the podcast of the Virginia Biotechnology Association.
This edition of the Virginia Bioscience Podcast features Dr. David Ayers, the CEO, Chief Scientific Officer, and one of the co-founders of Revivicor, a Blacksburg, Virginia-based company with expertise in the genetic modification of pigs for whole organ replacement and tissue regeneration. Revivicor's scientific team produced the world's first clone pigs and the first pigs that lack both copies of the gene responsible for triggering acute immune rejection in humans. Prior to the formation of Revivicor, Dr. Ayers was Chief Operating Officer and Vice President of Research and Development for PPL Therapeutics, where he directed all administrative and scientific activities of the U.S. division. In his role as VP of Research, he had direct oversight for the research and development pipeline for PPL on scientific platforms, including the therapeutic protein production in the milk of transgenic livestock and the cloning and genetic modification of pigs for xenotransplantation. Dr. Ayers is also the principal investigator on the company's two federal grants. One, a $1.9 million ATP grant for the development of stem cell technology, and the other, a $3.1 million DARPA grant for the production of human polyclonal antibodies in livestock against biowarfare agents such as anthrax. Prior to PPL, Dr. Ayers spent 8 years in scientific management in the pharmaceutical industry, specifically Abbott Laboratories and Baxter Healthcare. He holds a PhD in genetics from the University of Illinois Medical Center and completed his postdoctoral studies in the Department of Biology at MIT. He earned his B.S. in microbiology at Purdue University. David, thank you very much for taking time to chat with us today. Could you start a little bit about your background and how you got involved in science and when you knew you wanted to be a scientist?
I guess I knew I wanted to be in some form of science since I was about 10 years old. I was always drawn towards, you know, the biology classes, the labs that we were doing in high school. You know, got drawn into the zoology lab and chemistry and physics, and although most people seem to want to try and avoid chemistry and physics, and that's why they go into biology, I actually found that kind of interesting. So from a very young age, you know, I knew I wanted to do something in the biological sciences area. And then, but I didn't know exactly what, you know. Didn't know if I wanted to go pre-med. I didn't know if I wanted to do biology research. So I went into Purdue University as a general bio student. And in that first 2 years, did some internships in the microbiology area at Purdue and found that very interesting, doing kind of molecular genetic studies in bacteria and yeast. And so decided I was going to major in microbiology. And did some summer jobs, you know, working in food microbiology and enjoyed it. But during that time, you know, everywhere where I worked, and I worked at about three different internships or lab positions within the university, each time they said, you know, you need to go, if you want to do independent science, if you want to kind of lead your own projects, you need to go back to school. You know, you need to go on, get your master's, get your PhD, in order to have the kind of scientific independence so that something that comes out of your head is going to actually be developed. And so I went directly from, you know, an undergraduate degree in microbiology to a PhD program at University of Illinois Medical Center, and was interested more in the kind of mammalian genetic side because I was starting to think more about human therapeutics at that time and studying the mechanisms that would be important to mammalian systems, and started studying gene targeting and homologous recombination and the ways that we could actually genetically manipulate mice as models of human disease. And so that was the background of my PhD. During that time, I realized that I also didn't want to do the academic route. That's for some people. Now, for me, I decided I wanted things to be more applied. I wanted not to be doing a paper trail where you write a paper to get a grant, to get money to do research, to write a paper to get a grant. So, you know, I knew I wanted to do something more applied where, you know, I could do pseudo therapeutic human medicine without being an MD. And so the biotechnology area, the pharmaceutical industry, was very attractive to me. And so at that point...
Was that while you were still doing the advanced graduate work?
Yeah, it was while I was doing the graduate work. You know, knowing that I was going to finish my PhD, then I had to make a decision, you know, in my postdoc, was I going to go into a postdoc that kind of followed an academic path, or should I do a postdoc that would prepare me more for industry? And so I did a postdoc that was a completely different field, regulation of protein degradation and protein half-life, completely different than the molecular biology background that was my PhD. If I wanted to go the academic route, it should have been a very seamless kind of transfer of technology, so that then I could, my publication history would then follow me into the assistant professor role. I did the exact opposite. I said, I want to go in industry. I want to be as broad background as possible. I want to know biochemistry, proteins, DNA. And so my postdoc then, at that point, I had already decided that I wanted to go in industry. So I did a postdoc at MIT, and that was for 3 years, and went directly from there into the pharmaceutical industry and headed up a core facility for making mouse models for genetic disease and then testing them for small molecule drug development, and stayed in big pharma for 7 years, first at Abbott Laboratories in Chicago, and then at Baxter Healthcare in their gene therapy unit, before deciding that there was a little more freedom of taking a thought and an idea and actually applying it to the bench in a smaller technology environment like a biotechnology company. And so I joined what was at that time PPL Therapeutics, which is most known for cloning Dolly the sheep.
Right.
We didn't clone Dolly the sheep to clone people or learn how to clone people. We were doing that as a means of making genetically modified animals more efficiently, more reproducible, so that the therapeutic products that we derive from those animals, using those animals as bioreactors, would be more uniform, more of a lot that you could then use for pharmaceutical development or the therapeutic drug development. And so quickly kind of transformed from using mouse as the model to now using very large livestock as the model, and now have taken that with Revivicor when we spun out in 2003 as a standalone company from PPL, which was a Scottish-based company.
Right.
Now we are focused in genetically modifying pigs at Revivicor for taking cells, organs, tissues for solving the worldwide shortage of organs, as well as for diabetes applications, as well as for orthopedic applications, a whole variety of things. Basically, pig parts for people.
That's right.
Is where we've taken the company in that direction.
And your company cloned cows and pigs in Virginia as
yes.
well, right? And that was a huge media circus, I bet.
It was huge. I mean, we cloned the third cloned cow. So in a very short time period, in about a four-month period, three independent groups cloned the first cow, or first, second, and third cow. And we were the third. The first two were actually one company, and the third was ours. And we did that in collaboration with the Virginia Maryland Regional Veterinary College. So the clone was born there by C-section, and that brought a lot of attention and ultimately allowed them to become a center of excellence in the vet school, I mean, in the birth of cloned livestock, cattle in particular. And then as we started to branch out beyond using the cow as a bioreactor, trying to produce human proteins in the milk of cows, we were also developing these xenotransplantation products, which are using pig organ cells and tissues for human therapeutic use. And so we started developing pig cloning technology. And the kind of driver for developing that technology is a program called the Advanced Technology Program. And that's a division of NIST. And that program is unique in the world. And that program was responsible for and funded the cloning of the first pigs that had a specific sugar gene deleted, which allowed organ cells and tissues to be less likely to be rejected. And so, you know, it may sound like a promo for the ATP, but the ATP is actually the reason why Revivicor is here. That type of funding, which for a single company entity, $2 million over 3 years, is the kind of bridge funding that a small company like Revivicor, 20 employees in Southwest Virginia, need to get over the hump. And so we're very pleased that that funding entity was there. We subsequently got three more ATP grants, and so about 50 to 70% of our burn in any given year, starting in 1999 to now, has been funded through either ATP grants or Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation grants. We've gotten a grant from DARPA, the Department of Defense, to fund a pig project, which is trying to humanize pigs so that their immune system is fully human, so that now we can make human antibodies in the blood of pigs. And the first goal and the first commercial partner is the U.S. military for making very high-volume polyclonal antibodies, vaccines, against biowarfare agents such as anthrax, smallpox. And so we've got a grant from DARPA to fund that project. And so that those types of grants, as well as our primary financial partner, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center's Health Ventures Fund, have been how Revivicor, as a preclinical company without products on the market yet, has managed to keep its doors open for the last 4 years, and PPL before that, for 10 years before that.
So where are you in development process in terms of getting to the clinical stage and having products available?
Well, we have near, mid, and long-term products. Probably the longest-term, the Holy Grail, which really drives the, you know, the company, is the whole organs, hearts, kidneys, liver, are the kind of more longer-term projects. The more closer, near-term ones is using the pigs that we have already genetically modified that we know have overcome the hyperacute early rejection, decellularizing, removing the cells from certain tissues, whether they're tissues from the bladder, tissues from the skin, and using those as scaffolds, acellular scaffolds for things like rotator cuff repair, tendons for ACL repair for sports medicine applications, urinary slings, intra-abdominal surgery, hernia repair. These are all with decellularized products, so those are deemed to be a medical device rather than a biologic. And so it's a big difference from an FDA and a regulatory point of view, because one's a biologic that follows a 7 to 10 year approval path. The other's a medical device that's a kind of a 2 to 5 year device path. And so from that medical device path that we're developing these non-cellular devices from our pigs, we see that we hope to be able to launch something in human clinical trials within the next 18 to 24 months. Now, I said the whole organs were the long term, but there's actually some near-term possibilities with livers, where we could potentially bridge livers, where people that are in acute liver failure, they're going to die within a matter of days because of the toxins that are being built up because of liver failure. You could use a pig liver, whether it's outside the body or sewn in temporarily, to bridge a patient to getting a liver transplant, or, because the liver is the only organ that can regenerate itself, bridge it for 7 to 10 days to allow the liver to heal itself, and where you might not need a transplant. And so there are some whole organ bridge applications where we might be able to have things in human clinical trials in the next year or two. And then on the cell side, again, using cells derived from the liver, hepatocytes, putting them into a device where you use it kind of as liver dialysis. So, you know, patients that are in kidney failure, you know, do dialysis 2 to 3 times a week. If you were to put essentially 10% of the liver mass as purified cells into a device, perfuse your blood through it to kind of detoxify it, you'd be essentially doing liver dialysis, and that's another device product that we hope can be in clinical trials in the next 1 to 2 years.
So looking back when you were doing your research and thinking about getting into the private sector and industry, is now that you are the CEO of a biotech company, does it match your expectations, or how is it different than maybe you thought it might be?
I think the challenges are different than I thought they would be. I thought all the challenges would be scientific challenges and overcoming, you know, scientific hurdles and proving efficacy. And I'm finding that the bigger challenges are the regulatory challenges, some of the political, ethical challenges, hurdles, societal hurdles, because we're working in and we're pushing a lot of hot buttons. We're cloning, we're genetically modifying animals, or trying to use animal tissues in humans, animal blood for antibodies in human therapeutics. So, you know, there are where it might take a small molecule drug 7 to 10 years to go through the development process. If you look at the history of transgenic products, the first transgenic product was approved last year. It was by a company called Genzyme Transgenics. It's antithrombin 3 for sepsis. And that product took 13 years to get onto the market. And so there's a hurdle, that an extra hurdle, which has nothing to do with science, which has nothing to do with safety, which has to do with a regulatory hurdle, has to do with a societal hurdle that we have to overcome with our technology.
Right now, the United States is a leader in biotechnology, but do you think that we'll be able to hold on to that position over the long term?
Over the long term, yes. Over the short term, maybe not. Because countries like China, who are trying to find ways to feed their people, are turning to transgenic livestock as a near-term means to solve those goals. And that is through disease-resistant livestock, animals with improved milk yields, adding genes that affect muscle mass. So I think, you know, countries like China, like Korea, who, you know, are just looking to have bigger challenges in their society to get, you know, billions of people fed, may actually be the vanguard in the development of transgenic agriculture. And the good thing there is that hopefully that'll break down some of these barriers. And when, you know, our regulatory system can use that as kind of a, oh, well, maybe it is safe. It is reasonable. There are no hurdles beyond what the normal regulatory and safety hurdles should be through the regulatory process. So long term, I think, because we have the university system, we have the technical expertise, we have the financial infrastructure, I think, to support biotechnology more so than any other country in the world, the U.S. will win and become the long-term leader. In the short term, we've just got to get over some of these perception issues.
How about the workforce? Do you sense that there are enough people coming out of American universities today to fill the need for biotechnology companies, or will there be a draw for companies to outsource overseas?
Absolutely not. I don't think there are enough natural-born American citizens coming out of American universities to supply the need for big pharma or biotech or both. I think it has to start at the high school level.
Right.
It has to start at the, you know, there has to be an excitement generated in the freshman college biology class where, you know, people aren't just driven by the dollar, aren't driven by, you know, going into engineering because it's going to be the way to make the quickest buck, or into business because it's going to be the quickest buck. We've got to get people excited about the fact that in biotechnology, in molecular medicine, you know, you are changing the face of our healthcare system. And that should be exciting to people. And we need to try and find ways to get kids excited about science. You know, it shouldn't be that scientists are stereotyped into, you know, the Frankensteins and the nerdy, you know, with glasses scientist. You know, they should see this as an exciting avenue, as an exciting career choice. And that's the only way we're going to bolster the American-born workforce in biotechnology and biology.
Well, David, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Sure, I appreciate it too. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Virginia Bioscience Podcast. For more information, please visit us on the web at www.vabio.org.